From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. More and more women are taking the lead on the big and small screen.
What I'm interested in are real parts, not secretaries telling powerful men their wives are online too.
You read the man's part on purpose, didn't you?
It's the better part.
That's why we gave it to Steve Guttenberg.
We'll talk about the roles and jobs available to women in the film and television industry. But first, we talked yesterday about why Americans know so little about the Civil War.
Half my class is sitting there for the majority of the semester saying, well, we never learned this. We never were told this part of the story. We were never told this half of American history.
That's Dinah Ramey Berry, a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. She asked Twitter to give details of monuments that honor not Confederates, but slaves. Here are your first thoughts. Calvin Schermerhorn tweeted a picture of a plaque in North Carolina that honors Harriet Jacobs' ordeal. Jacobs was a writer and fugitive slave who spent 7 years concealed in an attic. Jabez Moore sent a picture from Sullivan's Island, South Carolina, where tens of thousands of people were trafficked in the 18th century. And Amanda tweets this, I moved near Kennesaw Mountain Battlefield and Kolb's Farm, part of the National Park Service, read the markers yesterday. They seemed a bit slanted. For the record, yesterday we talked about a complaint against Fulton County about about confirmation letters that were sent out to voters. At that point, we didn't know a lawsuit had already been filed by the ACLU of Georgia. We always love to get your thoughts, so call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on social media, and we might feature your comments on the show. In Atlanta, poverty is moving out of the city and into the suburbs. A recent study from Harvard finds the number of high-poverty neighborhoods in the metro area has tripled since 2000. That year, we had about 100 high-poverty suburbs. By 2015, more than 300. With me to discuss this is Kim Addy, Senior Director of Health for United Way of Atlanta. Hi there, Kim.
Hi. Good morning.
And also with us is Michael Rich, a professor in the Department of Political Science at Emory University. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning.
Michael, what is considered a high poverty neighborhood? How do we make that distinction?
Well, typically people define a high poverty neighborhood as a census tract with 30% or more of the population living below the poverty line. But some people use other thresholds. Some people might use 20%, some might use 40, but typically it's 30% or higher.
And Kim, why is suburban poverty more complicated than urban poverty, at least in terms of addressing it?
Sure. What we're finding in the suburbs is that there is, in terms of resources, availability of resources, our suburbs are not consistently structured to be able to address the issues that families have. In the speed that we see that the urban cities have been able to address. Typically, when we know about poverty in cities, cities are structured to address that. So availability of health services, education services, our federal safety net programs are much more available. In our suburban area, they are much more diffuse, so they're not simply created or put in one specific place where families can access them easily.
Michael, I assume that's because urban centers have a history. I mean, the poverty in urban centers is so longstanding that in many cases, especially political arenas, urban has become sort of an unspoken synonym for poor. So is that what's causing what Kim is talking about, this lack of resources, the fact that this is relatively new?
Well, it's two things. I think one, it's you're right. Traditionally, we've thought of the poverty problem as an urban problem, meaning largely an inner city problem, and therefore a variety of public programs, federal in particular, have focused resources to urban communities, to central cities, which in turn have built up the infrastructure over the years to put in place a variety of anti-poverty programs. But it's also been demographic, largely up until the 1980s and into the 1990s. Poverty was predominantly concentrated in central cities. But with the last census, the 2010 census, we see for the first time that there are more Americans in poverty living in the suburbs than in the central cities. So it's the poor have always been in suburbia. We're really only now becoming aware of how concentrated that problem is in terms of the rapid growth. Poverty has been increasing much faster in the suburbs than in the cities, though overall rates are still higher in the cities.
Kim, what do you attribute this to? Are there newer people that were not in poverty, say, pre-Great Recession, who now are? Or are people moving? What's causing the change?
Well, there is a shift that's happening. In the city, there, in terms of the cost to be able to live and rent, those prices are going up. And so it's causing our families not to be able to afford to live in those areas. And so our families are being redistributed in terms of a lack of a better word, into the suburbs because of that. Just affordability, also policy changes. So housing vouchers, the cost doesn't allow our families to have access to affordable housing. So the inventory of housing that's available, that's affordable, has decreased in our cities. And so our families are looking for stable housing. And so you'll find them moving into the suburbs.
And that complicates things further, Michael. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Kim Addy, you just heard, Senior Director of Health for United Way of Atlanta, and Emory Professor Michael Rich. Michael, one reason that causes further problems is because when people have to move further out of the urban center, Metro Atlanta is what is commonly referred to as a transit desert, is it not?
Absolutely. And that's a huge problem, particularly when we look at the distribution of the poor population in Metro Atlanta suburbs. Well, certainly there are large numbers in Clayton and DeKalb counties, which are in tight and have access to MARTA. But you get beyond that, certainly outside the perimeter, access to transit is much weaker and much less available. And so if you're on the edge, you don't have a functioning car, you're often out of luck in terms of your mobility to get to a job.
And Kim, this is not just a Metro Atlanta problem. Across the country, we see this shift of poor moving from, not just moving from the urban areas into the suburbs, but also people in the suburbs who were not poor, say 10 or 15 years ago, dropping below the poverty line. So if it's true that we just don't have the concentration of resources in the suburbs, what needs to happen to fix that?
Yeah, that has to be larger concentrations of partnerships that happen and that cut across regions. So United Way is an example, partners across county and border lines to be able to identify gaps that are happening in terms of services and working much more strategically. Even when you think about funding, just really understanding the needs of families that are happening and understanding how our poor families are very transient, so understanding the underlying issues, but being very strategic about how dollars are redistributed across the region, and also understanding what the barriers are in terms of the systematic barriers of affordability of housing and inventory and things of that nature. So what we're doing is really trying to bridge that gap between services that are available and the families that need them.
Michael, is there political will to address these things? I mean, it would require that, first of all, on a not only a federal level, but on a state level, to understand that this change is happening before the kind of levers of power can begin to move. Is the political will there?
It is in some places. I think we can look back to the mid-2000s. There were about 20 states that actually adopted poverty reduction targets. And they weren't just states on the West Coast and the East Coast. There were a number of states in the South that had legislated poverty reduction targets, formed task forces to look at what kinds of actions could state governments take to promote greater opportunity and help families climb out of poverty. And then the recession hit, and a lot of those plans got stalled in terms of their movement towards implementation. But there's also a lot of control that states have over the federal safety net in terms of things like Medicaid expansion, enactment of a state earned income tax credit to add to the federal earned income tax credit. That's probably the single most important anti-poverty tool we have that helps working families with children rise out of poverty. Other things like healthcare assistance, Medicaid expansion, job training, and the like. So many of the states that are experiencing the most sharpest rise in suburban poverty are states that typically tend to have weaker safety nets.
I want to hear this comment here from Elizabeth Kneebone. She's a fellow at the Brookings Institute, and she's talking about another wrinkle in the suburban poverty problem.
Poverty in these kinds of communities can be hidden. It can be harder to identify or even understand the extent to which need has grown because it may not be easily visible.
And so let's hear one other voice. Catherine Aravosis is a single mother in a suburb outside Chicago. Here she is speaking to PBS NewsHour.
It's those days when you get up and you really don't know what you're going to give your kids for dinner. And it can be a full-time job finding out how am I going to get glasses, her prescription is a year old, and where am I going to, you know, how do I go and get her the shot she needs, she's going to sixth grade, not having the health insurance, not having the basic things that people take for granted.
Kim, how difficult is it to identify poverty in the suburbs, and is there a problem with people actually coming forward to ask for help?
Yeah, United Way has developed what we're calling a child well-being index, and within that index, there are about 14 indicators. Out of the indicators, there's a composite score that is assigned to each community. So you have communities like Cobb County or Gwinnett County that has a score around 68% or 61%. What that tells us is that there are areas of high wealth, but there are also pockets of poverty. And so it is hard to identify because you have families that have moved and are transient, are staying in extended stay hotels. So it's hard to identify, but unless you're working with school systems, the homeless liaisons to understand who those children are, because they get on the bus just like anybody else would get on the bus, but you don't necessarily know where they're coming from, right? And you don't understand sometimes the issues that family is necessarily facing. And so having strategic partnerships with school systems and nonprofit partners to identify those families is very essential to helping stabilize families.
We've been talking about suburban poverty in Atlanta, at least in metro Atlanta. The numbers show that many of the poor populations are moving out of the urban area and into the suburbs. Our guests today were Kim Addy, Senior Director of Health for United Way of Atlanta, and you also heard Michael Rich, Professor in the Department of Political Science at Emory University. Kim and Michael, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, stories about the Atlanta neighborhoods you've never seen. But first, like Wonder Woman, ladies are kicking butt in the Georgia film industry. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. July was a big month for movies at the box office, including this one.
Baby right Jesus, there. Oh yeah. Jesus, please don't make me pee on anybody.
Stop taking that picture, please don't do that.
That is from the movie Girls Trip. It earned more than $30 million in its opening weekend and then came in the number two slot. It was produced by Atlanta's own Will Packer, and its cast, leading cast, was all women of color. And then there's Wonder Woman.
Never let your guard down. You expect a battle to be fair. A battle will never be fair.
That That is still the top grossing film of the summer, but of last year's 250 top grossing films domestically, only 7% were directed by women, and that's a problem. With me to talk about this is L'Oreal Broussard, Executive Director for Women and Film and in Film and Television Atlanta. Hi, L'Oreal.
Hello.
And also in the studio, I have Kalina Baller, host of the Credits podcast and regular Breakroom guest as well. Hi, Kalina.
Hello. Good morning.
So, L'Oreal, all of this joy over Wonder Woman's success, which is great, is paired by the report we just got yesterday called Inequality in 900 Popular Films. And that looks back over 9 years. And the statistics are not good. Less than a third of speaking characters on screen in 9 years were either girls and women, just over 30% in the top 100 movies of 2016. How are we to balance the success of movies like Girls Trip and Wonder Woman with this sort of depressing statistics?
I mean, it's important for people to realize, like, seeing these movies now in 2017, and the same evidence was of last year with Hidden Figures and other movies led by women like Hunger Games, you know, the whole series making so much money in the box office is like, you know, there's an age-old thought, I think, from the top executives that think that, you know, women and women of color can't lead these movies and make money globally and domestically, and that's just untrue. And so, you know, it's changing the thought pattern, I think, from the top down, because that's always, I mean, in Hollywood for sure, how things are going to get done. Because, you know, it always ends up coming down in film and TV to the bottom line. And if you look at the numbers have been showing for quite a few years now that women are leading the charge, you know, and those diverse casts at the box office are the movies that are, you know, bringing in the most dollars. So I think that that's a huge thing that people kind of, you know, glaze over and ignore. And it's like, and now we see these female directors in the past 5 to 10 years emerging, and we're not nearly anywhere where we should be, but there's a lot out there, a lot of talented women, you know, female directors. And I think it's just, we have to be champions for them. And the women that are in the top positions as executives and other places have to, you know, be able to pull them up as well.
Well, let's hear from the new Netflix series, GLOW, that stands for Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. It has a predominantly female cast. Here's a little bit of the opening scene where we meet the lead character, Ruth, played by Alison Brie. She's at an audition.
This is about justice. This is about holding on to what's ours. This is about my company and my name. And I will not be bullied into submission. Oh, I just want to say thank you so much for bringing me in for this. There are not roles like this for women right now. It's really, it's really great.
You're reading the man's part.
Kalina, that...
Great show.
I love that clip.
Yeah, probably the best 3 minutes of any pilot ever. But see, here's the thing. That movie is, that TV series is set in the 80s, but that could be set today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we keep getting these so-called movies and TV shows that over and over and over, I mean, going back to Mary Tyler Moore, prove a woman can lead a successful TV show, and mm-hmm. Lucille Ball. And yet decade after decade passes and we don't see these statistics out of Hollywood mm-hmm. or Yollywood for that matter mm-hmm. change much. Why?
I think that there's a difference between what's happening now and the audience, and the audience's tastes are changing. I remember from last week on here on your show when you were speaking in the break room about how hip hop has taken over as the, you know, the major
knocked rock and roll off the top number one.
Correct,
slot. Yeah.
Right, which is predominantly, you know, it's, you've got people of color, you know, predominant in that genre. So what's happening is it's a culture shift, period, and it's culture shift in terms of thinking of women just being just as viable in any position, whether it's executive or below the line, working in the film industry. And we're having more and more the women that paved the way for the directors and executive producers of today. They opened the doors, they flung them open wide, and now you have the rise of movies such as Wonder Woman and this amazing Girls Trip movie, which I am really excited to see. really
Girls Trip?
I'm really excited. No, I haven't yet, and I'm excited about it, actually.
Okay, that all sounds great.
Yes.
Except let me remind you of what happened with the movie Ghostbusters, produced actually by most of the original Ghostbuster men, but this one had an all-female cast, and there was a huge backlash, mostly from young men. And here are the lead actresses responding to that backlash.
Everyone seems to act like it's the, you know, it's the first time. That, like, there's a talking monkey or something crazy. It's
like we cast billy goats or something to play all over here. It's like
billy goats.
It just seemed like we did something completely wrong, and we didn't. We made a great movie.
L'Oreal, how then are we to balance the progress that has been made with something like that? I mean, there was a organized effort to crash that movie.
I think the difference, too, with a movie like that and other movies that are out that are, you know, female-led is that, you know, you're remaking classics. And that's a big problem, I think, that I've seen in Hollywood with TV shows and with big films is it's always hard, no matter if you're changing the race or gender of the roles. You know, I think that's just hard to overcome. And it was very, very unfortunate that, you know, there was this kind of huge push to go against that movie. But I think that, you know, when you're trying to reboot these cult classics and you are, you know, doing an overhaul into female characters, which I thought would have been a, you know, great movie and is exciting. And I think sometimes at the top where there's these directors or the writers who ever rewrote, you know, the script, I mean, I think there's other problems that people have to look at as well. And, you know, that get down to the bottom line of just like, you know, maybe the script wasn't as great. I didn't actually see Ghostbusters.
I did. It's not very good.
Yeah.
It wasn't good.
That's what I
enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. I'm glad. But here's a wonderful thing. Not to interrupt, I apologize, but here's a wonderful thing about what you just said is that, like you're saying, they're remaking classics, Okay, that's fine. We know that certain tropes don't work. But how wonderful is it that I could actually sit here and actually have a really full discussion and critique about a film that was a cult remake and a classic remake didn't work, and I'm able to critique it with an all-female cast. It's awesome.
Okay, so let's talk about whether there's a kind of role for women that is more helpful in this progress or not. Here's a little bit from yet another Netflix show. This is Jessica Jones, a classic a superhero character. She has a mind-controlling nemesis named Kilgrave. He likes to control her. The first voice you hear is Jessica's attorney talking about how she's jealous of Kilgrave's power.
Kilgrave wanted a leather jacket, live cello music, and the flattering smile of a pretty girl. What a waste. Could solve so many problems with his gift.
Gift?
I just meant if he was on our side.
What side would that be? The side that uses people, treats them like animals.
Jessica, do not
just to
take
throw them
this
away like they're garbage. The side that rips your life apart and destroys you from the inside out. Whose side exactly would that be?
Okay, so we have two very powerful women there, but let's focus on Jessica Jones because her superpower is in incredible strength, right? She doesn't disappear like the Invisible Girl. She kicks butt. Yeah. Is there a type of character like that, or say Charlize Theron in Atomic Blonde?
I'm fine. Right.
Yeah. Did you want to answer that, L'Oreal?
You're saying is there a type of character
which is more effective in the efforts toward progress?
I don't think so. I mean, you just as we're talking about Girls Trip being so successful, Hidden Figures last year being so successful, you know, there is the Hunger Games, there's the Jessica
Bridesmaids.
Jones. Bridesmaids, you know, like, I think what happens is that with these stories on the small screen and the big, they just need to be relatable in some way. And like, for a woman of color myself, seeing people on the screen that look like me is a huge thing, or that I think I could be, you know, as a child, that wasn't necessarily the case. And I think even as like, you know, men of color, like, you know, things like that, seeing those characters on screen in all different ways, because we see all the men as cowboys, as presidents, as police officers, as, you know, superheroes. I think the diversity is what helps, because we're seeing, you know, all these different types of women on screen. You're like, oh my God. In Girls Trip, you've got a super raunchy girl, a super successful woman, you know, one that's struggling financially but appears successful. And I've seen the movie. And the thing about that movie that's universal and it's making and it's doing so well is because you've got a universal theme of girlfriends getting together. They haven't seen each other. They were friends in college. They still are. Their lives have changed, and they still can be relatable. Like, everyone can kind of relate to some one of those characters, no matter if you're Black or white or Asian or Hispanic. And I think that to me is what's important. And in all of these, you know, different shows where the lead characters are superheroes or have superpowers or, you know, whatever they are, it's just cool to see that. You're like, oh my God, like seeing Wonder Woman, you're like, you didn't have that growing up. We had the comic book and, you know, even X-Men, like you have all these diverse, you know, people of color that are playing these characters now, these superheroes, which is amazing. And I think that's just showing something to the younger audience, these kids that wasn't there, you know, right, 30 years ago or 25 years ago.
Let's hear a from a woman who had a different kind of power. Here's Claire Underwood in the political drama mm-hmm. House of Cards, as played by the formidable Robin Wright.
Israel's back on board again, Alexei, so the moment you sell arms to Iran, we will shoot the planes out of the sky, the trucks off the road, and the ships out of the water. Now, maybe you'd be able to afford sanctions, but you sure as hell can't afford a war. Come back to the table. Engage us in good faith, or the resolution goes to a vote next week.
So Kalina is in here really enjoying that clip.
I love that show. This show. I love her. Too. I love the character. I mean, I love
everything
it.
About and she also played a kick butt general in Wonder Woman.
Yes, in Wonder Woman.
Yes.
She's amazing.
Yes.
I didn't even realize she was in this movie, in Wonder Woman. When I saw her, I screamed in the theater, made everybody mad. But that's beside the point. Back to House of Cards. So Robin Wright's character is relatable to me. I come from a family of high-powered women, and they were not, you know, conniving or whatever, but it just, I don't know. But
conniving or whatever.
Or whatever. But it showed a woman who did not have to wait for permission to get things done. And that particular scene from the clip that we heard, she was negotiating with another ambassador while in the restroom. It was the best thing ever. And he just didn't know what to do. Like, do I look away? Do I whatever? Because, you know, everybody is, we're all just walking around in society, and we have these, you know, norms that we're used to. And so he was like, mm-hmm. Oh, a woman's not supposed to, you know, pop a squat in front of me. Oh my goodness, what do I do? So it was so amazing to see that. I love to see more complex female characters like that. And we're starting to see more of that. And I mean, I could go on about House of Cards, but that's not why we're here.
It is not. But we have about 3 minutes left, and I want to get to the essential question, which is, when do we start to see these statistics change? When do we start to see more female directors? Not the standouts, not the occasional movie like Wonder Woman. When do we actually start to see all of this proof that women can do it actually result in jobs and films?
Look at Greenleaf. Look at
Queen Sugar.
Like you were about to say. I know what you're about to say. Because they have an active campaign of bringing on female directors, no matter if you're white, Black, whatever. Like, as long as you have a great story to tell and you have a vision, you know, the executive producers are going to give you that opportunity. We need more of that. And then it becomes normal.
That and with Queen Sugar, with Oprah Winfrey at the helm and Ava DuVernay, you know, do you have those women that are at the top that have the power to make decisions and pull people up? And that's, you know, what we need. And that's what we're seeing is, like, they made a concentrated effort in the first season of Queen Sugar. They hired all female directors. The second season, they went back to look for some of those directors, and they weren't available because they were getting hired on other shows, which is amazing, which is what you want, or other films.
Right.
And they had to look for a whole new set of female directors for the next season, which is amazing. And, you know, you need more people doing that, need more, you know, producers in those positions. And I've heard personally from people in Atlanta, and I produce as well, is that that's a goal. You know, they're like, when a director or when someone gives me a list of you know, of directors or writers or producers, whatever it is, and there's no females on it, or mm-hmm. there's only a few, I'm like, go back to the drawing board and give me another list of 5 to 10. Yeah, you know, like, do a little bit more work and research, because they're there.
Yeah.
You just have to work a little harder and not look at your first go around, which are your friends and the people you always work with. So, you know, it's just making more of an effort to do that. Yeah. And look,
to reiterate, it's all about opportunity. As long as you give anybody
and funding,
mm-hmm. absolutely. But it's opportunity. And if you give anybody opportunity that has talent, no matter where that talent comes from, you're going to have success. And that's what we're seeing now. And I believe that we're changing for the better.
That is Kalina Bowler. She is host of The Credits podcast. And we also heard from L'Oreal Broussard, executive director for Women in Film and Television Atlanta. L'Oreal and Kalina, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Of course, you're welcome. Thank you.
Just ahead, a Savannah church that was a stop on the Underground Railroad and a space for Dr. King to make his first public address. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The law says we have to have car insurance, but where does it say we have to suffer the highest rate increases of any state in the U.S.? Tomorrow we talk about why insurance rates are sky high around here, and we're wondering if your plan costs too much. Call and leave a message at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for that discussion. When I say the word noir, you probably get an image in your head almost immediately. Black and white movies, fedoras, guns, dark and gritty, where crime is king and the bad guys, well, they get away with it.
See, Mr. Gitz, most people never have to face the fact at the right time and the right place, they're capable of anything.
There have been times when I thought I only dreamed those days.
Sue came on a bus with dreams of Hollywood, and this is how they turned out.
Keep cool, Javi. On your side.
And you can tell folks better how terrible sin is if you know from your own experience.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
A few moments from some iconic noir movies. There's a new book out called Atlanta Noir that collects short stories with a decidedly modern and southern edge to the genre. The book came out today, and joining us now is Tayari Jones, editor and contributing author of Atlanta Noir. Hello there.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's talk, you addressed this a little bit in your introduction. Let's talk about the different take on noir. What have you kept from the traditional noir, and what is different?
Well, when I was collecting stories for this anthology, I just said, in my view, noir, it is not cops and robbers necessarily. It doesn't have to be procedural. We don't even have to have a detective. What we need to do is to explore, like, the dark side of the city, a place that I wanted a story that left you uneasy about things.
It's funny because the very first story sort of addresses what you're talking about. There's no detectives. We don't even know if there's a crime. I'm trying not to do any spoilers. But it does make us uneasy about the snowstorm that occurred in Atlanta. I mean, there's definitely something that the character in this story, thought was going to be no big deal and then turned out to be quite a big deal.
And I just feel like an Atlanta snowstorm is always a big deal, right? It's 3 inches, but it feels like 3 feet. So I felt like that story was kind of showing something really specific to us in Atlanta and that kind of slightly creepy feeling.
Yeah. And that's not the only story. Again, I'm going to try really, some of these stories are quite short, so it's hard to talk about them without spoiling anything at all. But that's one of the stories where we don't, the lead character doesn't necessarily make it to safety, right? We don't get a relief at the end.
Well, noir never provides you with relief at the end. I mean, the bad guys always win. good does not necessarily triumph over evil in noir. And I think that's why we read it, because there's a sense that you're immersing yourself in something kind of a little bit dangerous, kind of gritty, and that you're almost like putting your mind in a certain kind of danger.
Which part of noir is Southern? How does the Southern nature of these stories change the genre?
Well, in my opinion, this is why so many of the stories happen like between neighbors. Like in the traditional noir genre, a stranger comes to town and seeks help about something. But in this one, almost everyone's problem is with someone they know.
Right. There's no necessarily a mysterious figure. It's more secrets. And I was kind of surprised by the number of stories that dealt with secrets, things that people are not telling each other. Was that something you actually sought out as an editor, or did that happen organically?
No, it happened quite organically. I didn't assign the authors the kinds of stories I wanted. I gave them this broad definition. I let them choose the part of town they want to put the story in and just let them have it. But I think that we're Southerners. Secrets are what we do.
Why do you say that?
I just think, if you just think about it, we are very invested in our public persona. And we believe that what happens behind closed doors should stay behind a closed door.
Business.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's kind of where some of the grittiness comes from, is that we get a peek behind the closed doors in some cases. And sometimes it's a little scary.
And, you know, and that is also part of our culture. We are aware there's a door, that it is closed, and we all want to peek behind it. We are never surprised to find out that there is a closed door, but we are often surprised at what we find behind it.
Another thing that I found sort of a common thread among many of the stories was sort of the complicated relationship with Atlanta itself, right? There were a lot of people that were either saying, I need to get out of this town for one reason or another, or people who got here and were trying to make a transition in. How did you go about organizing stories that gave a picture of the city?
Well, like I said, I asked everyone before they started writing, what part of town do you want to write about?
And geographically.
Then, yes. And then what do you think makes that part of town unique? Like, I wrote my story about Southwest Atlanta. I was born in Southwest Atlanta. And what I find intriguing about Southwest Atlanta is that it is a predominantly African-American, I want to say almost entirely, but area. But the diversity within that group, I mean, you have people who live in million-dollar mansions to people who live on the street, all actually inhabiting the same quadrant of the city. And I was interested in the way this bounces off one another. And that was what drove me in my story, how you have diversity amongst this group that from a glance people may not think of as diverse.
So was there a story in there that particularly surprised you when you got it back? You must have had an idea of what kind of stories you might get. Were there surprises?
I was really unsure. Writers are very unpredictable. You have no idea what they're cooking up in their minds. You think you know a person. You think they're a normal, sane, kind of chill person. And they turn in this insane story. Like the story set in Peachtree City about the girls that pick up the guy on Craigslist and all manner of things ensue, or Sherry Joseph's story about the woman who murders her neighbor.
Yeah.
I know Sherry. She is a nice person. I looked at her like, how did you even think that up? Do we need to talk?
And her answer was?
No, I just thought it up. But I think that's the way you want to feel when you read these stories. Like, even my own story, after I finished it, I was a little startled by myself.
Did you know how your story was going to end when you began it?
Oh, I never do. I feel that for me as a writer, what makes the story suspenseful is that I, too, am in suspense. If I know the ending, you can feel me aiming for it, and then you will know the ending. But if I don't know it, you don't know it. We just walk down that road together.
How do you create suspense? One of the things that many of these stories do really well, I'm thinking of the story where he's supposed to be trafficking guns through the airport.
Oh, yes, Dallas Hudgens' story.
Yeah. So there's this, you know, from the moment it begins that this is going to be bad, right? And you're just waiting for what's going to happen. And I, you know, many of the stories are quite good at keeping you sort of on the edge of your seat. And I wondered, how do you do that as a writer? It's kind of simpler in a movie, right? You dim the lights, you have the spooky music coming up, you have people looking around corners. How do you do that intentionally in a story?
Well, there are several ways. Once, you need to get yourself a dangerous premise. Trafficking guns, that's dangerous. You are going to disguise yourself as a prostitute to meet your mega preacher father. That's dangerous, you know, so you get the dangerous situation. But then the next thing you do is simply you can just change words to make things a little darker. So instead of saying, you know, he opened the door, if he shoves the door, it has more energy. You can take just simple words and just get one with a little bit more oomph. And it just, all those little pieces together create this sense of dread.
Did you have to pull anybody back when you were editing? Did you have to pull anything back, or I guess pump it up?
Well, you know, I have a debut author in this collection. Her name is Alicia Parker, and she wrote the story about the woman who wants to be the first lady of Atlanta who receives a mysterious package. That story is kind of wild, but it used to be wilder. It was a little wilder. And she is a mild-mannered scientist by day who wrote this, like, totally freaky story.
Yeah. So, I mean, what did you end up liking about noir? And what were kind of its, I mean, what were its biggest challenges?
Well, I was familiar with the noir series. You know, we're finally getting ours. There are over 100 cities with the noir collection. We're just getting ours. So I was excited to put us on the map because I had read the others. And I liked the way the various authors took just hometown things and rendered them unsettling.
Yeah, they're scary.
Yes. And so I was excited, too, to look at Atlanta in a new way. I do feel like we're getting a weird rap on television lately.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, like, you know, now that we're the reality TV hub, I tell people I'm from Atlanta and they have all these, like, they think they know what type of shoes I wear. You know, like, they think I wear $1,000 shoes. I'm like, I don't wear $1,000 shoes. But we've got this kind of reputation now in the media.
Do you mention that many of the Real Housewives of Atlanta aren't originally from
Atlanta? Oh, I say that all the time. I'm like, they're not even from here. But so I felt in this that while not trying to do propaganda and create an Atlanta that where everything's great, because this is noir, nothing's great, but each one of these stories is quirky in its own way. Like, we are reinventing the idea of what all Atlanta is.
What is the difference between writing, what's the different challenge between writing a short story like this, and some of them are quite brief, tight, I should say, and writing a novel? How is that challenge different?
In a novel, you've got 300 pages to get done whatever you have to do. So you can go down tangents and explore side plots. But with a short story, every scene has to be consequential to the end. A short story has to be like, if something were to happen and five sentences were to fall off the page, you should be confused. But with a novel, I mean, have you ever gotten a novel and it was printed funky and like a couple pages were missing? This has happened to me. You're all right. You can make it up. You can figure it out.
Yeah.
But in a short story, if anything is left out, it's going to upset the equilibrium because everything counts.
Is that a limitation or a benefit?
Neither one. It's really just about the way you write. Because some people who are very talented, short, tight piece, the novel confuses them. They say, why do you need all those words? I don't know. I don't get it. So I think it's just different, the way different people vibe on the page. It was hard for me because I'm primarily a novelist.
Novelist, yeah. So then can these stories be read? I know that you as an editor ordered them in a specific order, but can they be read in any order?
Well, this is what I love about Short Story Collection. You can pick it up, open it anywhere, and read anywhere in the book. You can read it before bed. Well, I don't know if I read those
before bed. I wouldn't
read
those before bed.
But you can just read like a little piece, like when you're waiting in a waiting room or somewhere, and have a complete experience and put it down and come back to it, but not have that interrupted feeling you have with a novel.
That is Terry Jones, an Atlanta-based writer and editor of the new short story collection, Atlanta Noir. The book hit shelves today. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Now we invite you to church. Savannah's First African Baptist Church was recently honored by the Georgia Historical Society for its role in the civil rights movement, from hiding people on the Underground Railroad to being the site of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s first public speech in 1944. GPB's Ryan McFadden recently went to a Sunday service and brings back this audio postcard.
My name is Thurman N. Tillman, and I'm pastor at First African Baptist Church at Franklin Square, Savannah, Georgia. First African Baptist Church is the oldest black church in North America. It's the oldest black church because in 1773, George Lyle, who was a slave, was granted permission to preach up and down the Savannah River. In December of 1777, he constituted the church here in Savannah. When we talk about civil rights, we talk a lot, of course, about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Well, Dr. Ralph Maude Gilbert, who was the 13th pastor of First African Baptist Church, was a mentor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. Gilbert was ahead of his time, though, when it comes to civil rights, because Dr. Gilbert was able to get the first 9 black police officers hired in Savannah. He was very instrumental all through the civil rights movement, making sure that the NAACP was formed. He actually helped form or start the state NAACP and reactivated the Savannah branch of the NAACP. And he served as president of that organization. When I first came as pastor, probably for the first 5 years, the history really didn't faze me. I didn't think a lot about the history. I can almost remember when the history did hit me. One day when I was in the sanctuary and thinking about the building that we worship in now that was built in 1859 by members of the congregation who were mostly enslaved, it made me remember that they used money that they could have used to actually purchase their freedom or the freedom of their families and chose to build a sanctuary to God. I really do believe that come 1863, around the same period they were finishing this building and began to worship in it, Abraham Lincoln signs an Emancipation Proclamation that not only frees them, but frees who's ever in slave states throughout this nation.
That story was produced by GBB's Ryan McFadden. To see pictures of Savannah's first African Baptist church, visit gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. Do you know a historic place, maybe that doesn't get enough attention? Call us and let us know about it at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Facebook or on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.